Welcome to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. It is Wednesday, hump day. We're halfway through the week, and boy, do we have a great show planned for you today. All right, one of my favorite people and one of the greatest basketball players of all time, Isaiah Thomas, is going to join us in about 10 minutes, and we're going to go into a deep discussion, an interview with Isaiah about his portrayal in The Last Dance, Michael Jordan documentary. We're going to get to the bottom of a lot of issues between Isaiah and Michael. Stick around for that. We're going to do that for about 30, 40 minutes during the show, but we're going to start by going out to LeVar Arrington's crib and talk some football and talk some Ben Roethlisberger and talk some governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Wolf, who criticized Ben Roethlisberger, who posted a video yesterday of him working out, throwing the football with teammates. Big Ben had promised once he was able to throw the football, he would shave his beard, get a haircut, the whole nine yards. He posted a picture of himself getting that haircut, and the governor of Pennsylvania criticized Big Ben for not being safe during the coronavirus pandemic, and he doesn't want any Pennsylvania going to a barbershop. Barbershops are not open in Pennsylvania. All right, Marcellus, do you have a problem with the governor of Pennsylvania criticizing Big Ben here?
I don't have a problem with it. He's basically just saying no one's above reproach and in protection of all local and state citizens. He's like, you just got to follow the guidelines, follow the protocol. No one's above the law. I can hear Antonio Brian right now somewhere saying, there's that owner's mentality again by Big Ben, thinking he's above the law. And this is what it feels like in this situation. I think it's almost laughable. The thirst for the marketing and the campaigning really made them go beyond what they knew they should have done, which is do this in your own private confines. Do it at home. Hey, Big Ben, he's your friend, personal friend. Bring him to the crib. Problem solved. You go by any merchant, any business right now, you don't see a sign that says closed for COVID. Unless you the homie. That's not how this goes, and he tried to play it that way. So I think it's just pretty funny to see Ben get caught out like that. If he's your friend, like they say, bring him over to the crib, problem solved.
Yeah, I totally 100% agree with that. Listen, I have no problem with the governor addressing it for those very reasons that you just said, Marcellus. There's two ways he could have handled this, right? He could have, one, brought the barber to his crib. Or two, if you slide in silence. You could have cut that video where it could have showed exactly what you wanted, how you wanted it to be showed. Foresight, you know, 2020 hindsight, it shows that you made a mistake in engaging what you did. But I think it was responsible for the governor to address it, because all those beloved fans, I'm a Steelers fan, so I know how big Ben is in Pittsburgh. All those fans of Ben are going to be sitting there talking about, it's time to go get a trim. Let me go get myself trimmed up. And now it takes away the danger that may exist, you know, with where we're at currently.
Listen, and I just want to introduce this for everybody watching at home. Marcellus and LeVar are parents, they're fathers. They have a perspective on this that I don't have as someone who isn't a parent or a father. I'm like a lot of people in this country. I'm ready to go. And consequences be damned. And I say that in all seriousness. There's a lot of people. My barber comes over here to my apartment, cuts my hair. I'm not going to call his name out, but he's been meeting people at his shop, a very popular shop here in Los Angeles, and cutting their hair no different than what Big Ben and his barber, I think his name's Carlos, were doing. Look, there are people, and we have focused. The media has done an amazing job of focusing on the people that have gotten sick and died from coronavirus. There's been almost no attention paid to the businesses and the people that are being destroyed economically because of our reaction to the coronavirus. And so I look at this barber. I look at what Ben's doing here by throwing some shine on his barber. And I think they're subtly, that's their little subtle way of protesting, like, hey, man, we've all sat around and thought about the consequences, and with the time we're in, we are ready to move on. We can't move in fear for the rest of our lives. I say that with the end of I said at the beginning, I'm not a parent. Marcel and Savar have a different perspective than I do, but I think the governor here should shut the hell up. No harm, no foul here. I didn't see a bunch of people in this shop. Big Ben and the barber, to me, totally in the right here.
Look, you don't have to be a father, parent, married to not break the damn rules, not to break the law right now. Like, this is their rule, and you're supposed to respect the governing body in this situation. And you did some dry snitching right there on your barber. He better watch out. You were that close, Jason. That close to letting them go.
Yeah.
But that said, man, with... Look, I understand the economic balance in this equation, health, economy. I get that. I'm with you. But there's a time and place for everything. And LeVar said it. If you're going to slide, why we all got to know where you slide, man? Just get it done with the effect. I think that this was a bad look on them because they didn't see this coming. They thought this was going to be a glowy, Ben's back. Everyone in Pittsburgh's going to love this because I'm Big Ben and I'm back. But they didn't look at it from the other perspective, which is like, dude, did you have to break the rule? Did you have to be the one? And this goes to the narrative of Big Ben in general in that locker room, some of the issues and dissension. He always got to be the one. So if you think you're above the law, continue, Big Ben. You do it. I ain't mad at you, but I'm also not mad at the governor for calling you out.
You say health be damned, Whit, but imagine if a couple weeks from now, we really are looking at Ben Roethlisberger deal with being sick. Like, what if that were to happen? And I don't know if that would be where we could actually say, okay, it happened when he went to see the barber. But, man, if I'm the governor and I didn't say anything and I saw this and this man comes back sick a couple of month or so from now and I know that I could have said something that was responsibly making sure that the fans, the people – need to be paying attention to what the rules are to stay safe and stay healthy. I feel like that was a responsible address by the governor.
Look, I think the governor can tell everybody to stay at home and stay locked up in your house forever, and you'll all be safe, and you'll just wait on death to come visit you at your house. Big Ben and that barber, to me, this was their little quiet little protest. They're on the side of the people that's like, enough is enough. Enough is enough. Look, people take risk in this society. People sacrifice their health for freedom. That's been the history of America and this planet. Freedom is a value more important to a lot of people than their own life. The history of America is littered with that. Go back, you know, to the Civil War. People knew they were going to die, but they believed in something and were willing to sacrifice their life in service of that. And so I don't want to equate Ben and the barber to that.
A free haircut?
But I'm just telling you, this is a protest. Give me liberty or give me death is what a lot of people believe. And so I'm just, this country's founded on freedom. And I'm just sorry. We cannot be denied our freedom forever. And I say that knowing, look, I'm overweight. Corona may come get me. Don't shed no tears for me. I'm good with God. I'll be okay. There's a lot of people that believe that.
Funeral.
All right, we got to keep
it. We're going to do the Zoom call for you.
We got to keep it moving.
Don't worry about it.
We're going to keep it moving. Isaiah Thomas is right around the corner, and we're going to get into this Last Dance documentary. Speak for yourself from the crib, presented by Hyundai. More after this. A healthy lifestyle should be easy, right? Eat veggies, drink green smoothies, exercise to get your heart rate up, and do yoga to bring your heart rate down. Woo! Maybe not so easy. But there is something that helps improve everything, and you can do it with your eyes closed. It's sleep. Sleep Number knows what it takes to sleep your best. The Sleep Number 360 Smart Bed lets you choose your ideal firmness, comfort, and support on each side, your Sleep Number setting. It's the perfect solution for couples. These beds are so smart, they respond to your every move and automatically adjust to keep you sleeping comfortably all night. Proven quality sleep is life-changing sleep. And now, for a limited time during the Memorial Day sale, save $1,000 on a new Sleep Number Special Edition Smart Bed, a queen, now only $1,799. You only find Sleep Number at Sleep Number stores or by visiting www.sleepnumber.com.
That's my dog!
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. All right, we're about to do an interview I've been looking forward to since the beginning of the Last Dance documentary, certainly since they focused on Michael Jordan and the Bulls' rivalry with the Detroit Pistons. All right, let's go out to New York and bring in Isaiah Thomas. Just for transparency, Isaiah Thomas is one of my favorite human beings on the planet. I just want to establish that up front. I probably got a little bit of bias here, but not really. I'm going to keep it real. Isaiah, thank you for joining us. We heard during this documentary, 10-part documentary, Michael Jordan called you an asshole, said that he hates you, has animus over the lack of a handshake and the supposed lack of respect. We know how Michael Jordan feels about you. How do you feel about Michael Jordan?
First of all, I was shocked to hear that from him, because he and his producer, they actually approached me to sit down and do the interview for The Last Dance. And, you know, we went back and forth in terms of timing and place, and finally settled on doing an interview. And, you know, I got from his producer that they wanted me to be involved, and I chose to be involved. And I didn't know that this is what was coming, because, you know, he and I have been to dinner before. He, Ahmad Rashad, and I have been to dinner before. We've seen each other in different places at NBA functions, and I never got any type of animosity or bad feelings from him towards me. So I don't have any bad feelings towards Michael Jordan, or have I ever had any bad feelings towards Michael Jordan. I'm like me and my family who sat down to watch The Last Dance. We were pretty surprised to hear those words come out of his mouth, especially since it was following, an apology that I had given to him on national television.
You kind of answered this question, so you don't have to spend long on it, but was there anything that transpired off the court between you and Michael that may fuel this level of animus 30 years down the road?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, really, I think the only thing that people kind of go back to is, and I've said this, the lapse in judgment that I had, in terms of not shaking his hand after a game. Just to contextualize that and give you the full narrative around that, you know, before that, they won, I think it was after game 3, Michael Jordan called us undeserving champions and said that, you know, we were bad for basketball and everything else. Now, we had a long, hard journey to become champions. We had to fight through Boston. We had to fight through L.A. And we had a lot of ups and downs, just like every champion does. And we felt that we deserved our championship and worked hard to get it. And to have him say that we were undeserving, that really did cut, and it cut deep. So when we got beat and we got swept and they won, they beat us 4-0. A lot went into that. You know, first we were celebrating with each other, thanking each other for our journey. But then a decision was made. Lambeer said, hey, let's, you know, we just gonna, you know, walk off. And that's what we did. Now, was it the right thing to do? Probably not, looking back 30 years later. But what went into that in terms of our emotions, the way the city was feeling at that time, for someone to call us undeserving in terms of what we had been through, at that particular moment, we didn't feel that they deserved a handshake either. So now, was that the right thing to do looking back 30 years from now? No, it wasn't. We should have been bigger as champions, and I should have been bigger as a person to really stop and ignore the noise that had come after game 3 and did the right thing. And I apologize for that. I did it. I'm doing it now, and I did it back then, too. So I don't know he has that type of animosity that he's exhibited. He seems to be angry at a lot of people right now.
I would agree. He seems to be a guy that holds a grudge as well. And I'm just wondering if this could be a competitive thing, because people don't realize this, but you're only 1 year older than Michael Jordan. You entered the league before him, but you're really only 1 year older. And during the 1980s, when you were in your prime, in the 1980s, before you hurt your wrist, before you got on the other side of your career, you were pretty dominant over Michael Jordan, 32-16 in the 1980s in the regular season and postseason. Could this just be a competitive thing from you and the Pistons beating up on him, wins and losses?
It could be from his point of view. And by the way, that number should be 37-16, including playoffs. And so Michael Jordan at that time, from 84 to 90, in 91, I had basically what they would call career-ending wrist surgery. And, you know, I never was the same again. But when we were all young and healthy, from 84 to 90, you know, the numbers speak for themselves. You know, he wasn't really my competition. My competition was Bird and Magic, trying to catch the Celtics, trying to catch the Lakers. You know, Chicago at that time, and Jordan at that time, from 84 to 90, before my wrist surgery, you know, he just, that wasn't my competition.
Let's stay there for a minute. In the 80s, because he didn't have tremendous success against you, Magic, or Larry. But then, once you guys started to come down the hill somewhat, you saw his ascension and dominance. Is that how you guys felt?
Well, and that's a natural progression of the champion and of teams throughout the league. I mean, when Boston was at their absolute best, we gave them competition, but they were better than us. I mean, and as they got older, as they got a little bit more banged up, we were able to catch them. Now, what we were able to learn from Boston during that process, the Detroit Pistons, and every time you hear us talk about who we are, what we became, we do not mention ourselves as champions without saying the Boston Celtics, because those were our teachers. Those were our mentors. Those are the people that really taught us how to win, and they gave us the heartaches. And Bird, Mikhail, DJ, Ainge, you know, Max, I mean, ML Carr, Perry, they were great to us as teachers. And when we got to go to the finals and finally beat them, then I ran into another one of my mentors, which was Magic Johnson, who had let me become a student under him, learning how to win championships in the NBA. Learning that Laker organization, learning that Celtic organization. And I'm sure all of you can look back and remember, you saw me at every NBA Finals game when the Celtics and the Lakers were playing. And not only was I there as a fan, but I was there as a student, taking notes, learning how to win, how to put together an organization, and not just be a basketball player in the NBA, but to become a champion. And that's what we became. We became a champion. And we were pretty dominant in our era.
And yesterday, during an ESPN interview, Horace Grant accused Michael Jordan of being dishonest in the documentary. Do you think the documentary portrayed you and the Pistons honestly?
You know, this is a question that I think people, I would hope people would one day go back and watch the games that the Pistons played, that we actually played in, because the narrative about us over the last, you know, 20 plus years has been, you know, you take a couple of clips of some hard fouls, and then you say, okay, this is Detroit Pistons. You take a couple of movie clips, and then you put some words around it, and you say, this is the Detroit Pistons. No, that was part of us, but that was also part of the NBA. And as a matter of fact, that was part of the Chicago Bulls, too. I mean, Charles Oakley, who people say probably is the toughest player and the toughest person to ever come through the NBA. Well, guess what? He was a teammate of Michael Jordan's, okay? Horace Grant was a teammate of Michael Jordan. Bill Cartwright. You know, those guys were tough people. So it wasn't like, you know, we just came in and bullied them and beat them up. Okay, well, they bullied us and beat us up too. I got some scars on my head from Bill Cartwright. I got some blood coming down my eyes just as much as George got hit. I got hit just as hard. We didn't complain about it. That was just part of the game. You see Robert Parrish knocking Lambeer's head off in a playoff game. We got up, we played the next game. I mean, that's just how it was then. But, you know, so this narrative about the Pistons were so rough and tough and everybody was so soft, so they had to legislate the game because the Pistons were beating everybody up. Time out. That's not quite how I remember.
You anticipate seeing Michael Jordan at some point and clearing the air of why he would hate you 30 years later?
So first of all, there's no air to clear from my point of view, because I genuinely don't have anything against him, nor did I ever. I'm not that kind of guy. I played out on the floor in between the four lines, and I'm okay with saying, you know, the time that we competed when we were both young and healthy, and he didn't have injuries and I didn't have injuries, I'm pretty confident in saying, you know, my record was pretty dominant against him and against his team and in terms of my team. Now, outside of the four lines, I got nothing but love and respect for the brother in terms of, you know, who he is, what he's done, and what he's accomplished. You know, we as former players, current players, you know, we owe a great deal of debt to Michael Jordan and LeBron James, because what those two have done for all league and all game financially and raised it to another level, you know, it's been great for all of us. We get to be on this show and talk basketball 24/7, 365 during COVID because of what, you know, Jordan has done and what LeBron has done. So, you know, we as a collective family, brotherhood, so forth and so on, I believe in that. And that's what I live by and go by. So I don't have anything against the brother. Now, if he puts on number 23 and I put on number 11, okay, yeah, we're going to go compete. But outside of that, that's all it was for me.
You mentioned the importance of Michael Jordan in terms of elevating the league. That, to me, says that the league had a major investment in Michael Jordan. David Stern and the whole league, they poured all their chips into Michael Jordan. He was the establishment. You, as the head of the players' union during your playing career, you went head-to-head with David Stern and the league. Real battles that you did pretty well in. Did you know at the time that you were taking on the establishment the way that you were, and that it would define your post-career the way that it has?
Absolutely, we did. Not only myself, but the Detroit Pistons as a small market and what we stood for in the game of basketball at that particular time. Because at that particular time, no small market team had ever dominated the way we were dominating. It was always Boston, L.A., Philadelphia, and Chicago. Those were the four big markets that the league wanted to promote. And we as a players association and players knew that it helped when those four markets were doing well, that the league does well. Now, what we were able to do as a small market team is to create the next generation for a San Antonio Spurs to happen. Because the San Antonio Spurs, what they became is really, you know, the fast forward or uptick of what the Pistons were in Detroit. Small markets team dominating, so forth and so on. The other thing that we were able to do from we were the first team to experiment with changing all colors. We were the first team, we went to the silver and black, you know, the Raider colors, because we met Al Davis after Pat Riley wouldn't give me no ice after I sprained my ankle game 6. We had to go to the Raiders facility to train to try to heal up. But, you know, so we took on the silver and black. Mike Ornstein gave us the Raider logos and everything else. So we started playing with all colors. not only did we start playing with our colors while I was the president of the Players Association moving forward, then we start upgrading our hotel. So instead of staying at, you know, the three-star hotels, we upgraded and went to the five-star hotels. We changed our travel. We were the first team to get our own private plane and start moving around the league. So that, of course, we knew we were attacking the establishment, and the establishment didn't like what we were doing and what we were representing, not only as team, but also as players. The things that we were talking about in terms of race, class, and gender, that was coming out of our Pistons organization, that was coming out of, you know, our interviews, the discourse that we put out into the public, we were very, you know, against what, not against, but forward thinking in terms of where the league was going and where we thought the league should be. So, you know, and when you asked me, did I know that we was going against the establishment? So that question is absolutely yes. And by the way, we saw Michael Jordan as part of us, as a union, as a players group. And by the way, all those guys that they said don't like me, they voted me to be their president and represent them. but Michael Jordan was, at that time, we were getting 53% of the gross. So when we looked at Michael Jordan, not only did we look at him as a great basketball player and someone who was elevating the league, but we also looked at him as 53% of the gross. So he was one of us, and he was helping uplift the league. So all, my job as the president was to make sure that we kept the 53 cents on a dollar, and the owners kept 47. Well, at that time, they wanted a little bit more, and we fought and battled. And I'll say, you know, most of the battles, when I was president of the union, and vice president of the union, we won most of our battles at the negotiating table, if not
Isaiah,
all.
Isaiah, final question before we go to commercial break, and we'll come back with some more questions. But if you could answer this in 60, 90 seconds, and take as long as you want. Michael Jordan called y'all bad for basketball before sweeping y'all. Listening to what you just said about the league and his importance and elevating, could you understand why David Stern and perhaps the league thought the Pistons were bad for basketball? Because y'all were standing in the way of Michael Jordan.
Yeah, I can understand the way that that they were thinking it, probably in the league office, because monetarily, as we've seen, you know, this is a business too. And you definitely, you know, while the Pistons were making money and the Bad Boys were making money, you know, in the 80s, the highest rated games in the 80s, Pistons versus Celtics, Pistons versus Chicago, Pistons versus Lakers. They have one thing in common, the Detroit Pistons. So the highest rated games in the 80s were the games that we played in. The merchandise that was selling at that time, you know, Bad Boy Piston merchandise, you know, people were wearing it everywhere. And then when you look at the crowds that we were bringing in at that time, we were putting, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 people in the Silver Dome. So what we were doing energetically, and also what we were doing from a financial standpoint, we were bringing more people to the game. Now, what league office understood is that Jordan and Chicago being a bigger market than Detroit, Jordan having a Nike behind him that was moving into marketing, those connections and those two together definitely, you know, elevated him in our league, in us as players, to another level. So I do understand the business aspect of it.
All right, don't go anywhere. Isaiah Thomas is going to rejoin us, and Marcellus is going to ask him, would Michael Jordan be Michael Jordan without Isaiah Thomas? Speak for yourself, From the Crib, presented by Hyundai. More after this. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself, From the Crib, presented by Hyundai. All right, we're going to continue on with our interview with Isaiah Thomas, who was a co-star in the Last Dance documentary. Marcellus, keep us rolling.
Do yeah, I get an Emmy?
Isaiah. Yeah, we're going back, man. And I loved how you said your wars with the Boston Celtics helped you guys as the Detroit Pistons on your journey. Now, I want to know, do you feel that you and the Pistons going to battle with Michael Jordan has helped Michael Jordan became what he was and what he is?
You know, that's for him to speak to. You know, I can only really tell you about my journey and who my teachers and mentors were and what I learned from losing and what I learned from them and give them credit for it. You know, he has to speak for his journey and he speaks for himself. And I can tell you who, you know, Magic and Bird and Julius Erving definitely helped make me the champion that I became in the NBA. The Lakers and the Celtics and the Philadelphia 76ers definitely helped shape the Detroit Pistons into becoming the champions that we became as a basketball team.
Okay, here's one that I know you can answer, and it's going to be in your words, and I want to go deep to the heart. Do you feel that Michael Jordan had no role in you making the Dream Team? Be real.
You know, up until the last dance, I didn't think he did, you know, and I took him at his word. But now listening to him and Rod Thorne and how they portray me, and you know, I kind of question it now. you got to question it, you know. But up until then, you know, up until I guess last week, I hadn't laid that card on him, nor had I laid it on anyone. But just watching a documentary and seeing how he and Rob were talking and communicating, there's, you know, I guess he said, I guess in his words, having me around would have made him feel uncomfortable. So,
Isaiah, one of the observations I had watching this documentary that kind of took me by surprise is, like, I started thinking, like, Isaiah and Larry Bird are more alike than Isaiah and Magic Johnson, Isaiah and Michael Jordan. You and Larry come from tough, hard-knock backgrounds. Michael and Magic come from nuclear, middle-class families. They're kind of corporate and glitzy. You and Larry Bird, kind of lunch pail, rough competitors. Has that ever crossed your mind that it's like you and Larry actually have more in common than Michael and Magic?
You know, and then we you know, both, he played at Indiana State, I played at Indiana. You know, definitely there's a lot of commonality there. And Larry and I have always had a great relationship. And whenever we got out on the floor, you know, you can see in All-Star games, like, he and I, we just magically connected and always, you know, found each other. And when the whole thing that in terms of competing against the Celtics and watching our team grow, you know, Larry, Kevin, Dennis Johnson and ML Carr, them guys were constantly, you know, doing an exhibition season, you know, even though they would be shooting, you know, little jabs at you, but they was always letting you know, you're getting closer. And I never forget the first time Larry played against Dennis Rodman. We were in Hartford, Connecticut. We had just drafted Dennis and we were playing down in Hartford. And I told Larry, when they were getting off the bus, I said, I got something for you this year. This guy, Robin, you know, he can defend. And Larry's like, nah, we'll see when we get out on the court. So this exhibition game, we like talking trash, so forth and so on. Anyway, they end up beating us in Hartford. But as we're getting on the bus, he looks at me and he goes, y'all got two nice rookies. And he was talking about Robin and Sally. So every now and then they would let us know that we were on our way.
The other observation I had was the feud between you and Jordan just comes down to city kid versus suburban kid. Your thoughts?
So I'm going to call time out on a few because really I wasn't fighting him. I was winning all the time. I was winning the majority of the time. So why am I mad at him?
Mm. Woo, at least that competitor came out.
Yeah, at that point in time. Yeah, of course, we all competitors. I mean, all of you have played, right? You know, we play different sports, football, basketball, but absolutely we competitors. And the guy who's winning all the time or most of the time, you ain't mad at nobody. You kind of happy.
Isaiah said, I ain't going to punch Isaiah, down. Okay, here we go. Here's the thing, Isaiah. Has the success of this documentary.
I think the Last Dance.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I think the Last Dance documentary is a good look.
You go. I'm done.
As the Last Dance doc, I think it was a good look for you. Do you agree? Overall, I think it's a good look for you.
I think for the Detroit Pistons and also historians of the game, because what the Last Dance has done, it has really allowed the younger generation to really go back and take a critical look and critique the actual history of the game and recognize some players and some play that they may have overlooked. I mean, all 1990 NBA Finals, and all 1989 NBA Finals, they talk about small ball being a new thing and dominating the NBA. Well, I think what people have discovered is that in 1989, Joe Dumars, small shooting guard, was the MVP of the Finals. 1990, Isaiah Thomas, point guard, small point guard, MVP of the NBA Finals. And then when you look at our three-point shooting ability during 89 and 90 and where we had evolved to as a basketball team and what Bill Laimbeer was as a three-point shooting center, you know, we still hold records from the three-point line in the NBA Finals in terms of field goal percentage. Now, fast forward to 2020 that we're in now, when everyone was talking about, oh, the game has evolved. I think what Last Dance has brought them back to from an offensive standpoint is like more teams play like the Detroit Pistons now and more point guards play like Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars now than they were back then. So the impact and influence that we've had on the game is starting to be recognized now, because I would venture to say there in the NBA right now, there's more backcourts like Dumars and I than there are like, you know, Pippen and Jordan. And I'll say, and let me just say this, I don't mean that as a slight. I mean that because Pippen and Jordan were such freaks as athletes that it's very difficult to find a Pippen and a Jordan with that type of athleticism that you can put out on the floor together. It's easier to find an Isaiah and a Dumars and make a team. Athletically, what Pippen and Jordan were together out on the floor, those two are rare, and they show up every 60 years or so.
Now, you speak to influence. Has the success of the documentary, has that made you want to go out there and do the Isaiah Thomas documentary?
You know, there's a time, there'll be a book and there'll be a doc at the right time. And my story is a pretty interesting story from a basketball standpoint. Growing up on the west side of Chicago, activism, sports, education, and, just coming from where I came from and representing what I represent, I hope people will find it interesting when it happens.
All right, Isaiah, we're going to ask you to stick around for one more segment. We've got a few more questions. Isaiah, you're doing a great job. Love it. Speak for yourself from the crib, presented by Hyundai. More after this. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib, presented by Hyundai. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley, joined by Isaiah Thomas. Let the interview continue. Marcellus?
Yeah, I got to tee this one up for you because, you know, listen to Whitlock all the time. He loves you. He's a champion for you. I love you as well, Zeke. But he argues that the media has been unfair to you based on this documentary as well. This is a bad portrayal of you. So can you clear up, what's the biggest misconception you've gotten from this documentary?
I don't know. I mean, I look at it how can I say this? I mean, I guess Walt Whitman, I think, wrote the poem, and he used the words vast with multitudes. And I do have multitudes in terms of as a person that played basketball inside the four lines. And then there's a person that's outside of the four lines. And too many times people want to say that the way you competed and the way you played is the person that you are. And those are different things. And I don't live my life the way I play basketball. that's just not who I am. Now, I did have a personality as a basketball player, but I also have a personhood as a human being outside of the four line. And so I would say the multitudes that I carry, I've always tried to extend and be the best in those multitudes of lanes that I had to live in and be judged and critiqued in. So that's the best way I can really answer that question without, you know, getting too far out, which I probably did in answering the question.
Isaiah, we're gonna end on this note. We had this discussion last week, and I wanted to ask you. We found an irony that basically Michael Jordan is being celebrated in this documentary for his bullying tactics towards his teammates. But somehow you and the Pistons are villainized because the Bad Boys allegedly bullied opponents. Do you find that fascinating, interesting, bothersome?
Well, I find it interesting and fascinating that the language and the labels that have been extended and put on the Pistons as a team, those same labels as teammates, the Bulls, put on each other. So, you know, and just watching the doc, I'm surprised that, there seemed to be a lot of, dysfunction or dislike within their team. But I guess that speaks to, you know, how great a player Jordan was to overcome all that and still win championships and be this dominant.
So Michael Jordan was able to overcome himself and still win championships. I won't put words in your mouth, but that's my takeaway.
I can only speak for the Pistons, and I can only tell you what I'm observing, what I'm hearing from their teammates about each other, which is, you know, interesting.
Isaiah, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate the context. Look, I've been on the record. I'm a Michael Jordan fan after this documentary.
I am
you,
too.
Horace Grant.
53% gross.
Yeah. I'm starting to back off a little bit, though. It just Michael Jordan, a very complicated soul, and he needs to let this damn grudge go. He owes you an apology. You were man enough to give him an apology. to sit there right before sweeping y'all and talking about y'all were bad for basketball. How the hell were y'all supposed to react? But I'm going to let you go. You don't got to comment on that. Thank you very much. Uncle Jimmy's just around the corner. We'll have our final thoughts on the Last Dance documentary. Speak for yourself from the crib presented by Hyundai. More after this. All right, welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib presented by Hyundai. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley on a Wednesday hump day. All right, time to go out to Uncle Jimmy's crib. Get his thoughts, perhaps, on Isaiah Thomas or the Last Dance documentary. What do you want to comment on, Uncle Jimmy? Last Dance or Isaiah Thomas?
Hey, man, I want to talk about the Last Dance. You know that's what I want to talk about. Hey, man, the Last Dance accomplished exactly what Michael Jordan wanted to accomplish. He showed you exactly how he felt about LeBron James. See, man, whether y'all realize it or not, this documentary was full of NBA legends, NBA mythical gods, like the Mamba, like the Worm, like the Bird, like the Skeleton. I mean Reggie Miller. But you know what? You heard from everybody but the king. You know, and that's what LeBron James can't understand. He tried to give Michael Jordan an olive branch, and Michael Jordan whooped his ass with it. And he can't understand. What's the problem? He ain't cut from the same cloth.
We're done.